might just want to meet him, I don't know. And he was going to meet the president, the premier of the Russian state, and I've forgotten who else, Tony Blair, and I can't remember who else. And then when I rang him and said, you know, we got the city, I thought he was going to say to me that, look, unfortunately, given I have all these weighty engagements, I shan't be coming. But you could see he was so terrified by Parliament. I wish he'd taken Parliament as seriously when he was a minister, as he is doing at the moment. And it also reveals that things are more troublesome to Rani in ESCOM than we imagined, that the chairperson of the board decided to forego all these major international commitments to be here. Of course, I'm being facetious. I think Linda knows me well enough to know that's not true at all. But we're very happy that he's here. I won't explain why he's here. I'll be more embarrassed than he would be. So I won't explain that. But in any case, welcome in particular to him. And then, of course, to Rani Gavashi and his team, whom we know, so there's no need for introductions. Also, Professor Anton Eberhard, who's new to the committee, is here also to consider what the department, and more especially ESCOM, has to say and respond to it. The department, I've discussed very quickly with the various people on the agenda today whether they really need the time we've allocated to them. I'm pleased to say they're very happy to forego some of that time, which means the chairperson of the committee will have more time to speak. I'm not being serious. I also want to welcome, by the way, Kevin Patrick from the United States. For those of you who Peter will know, and I think Mr. Musa will remember, that the National Democratic Institute worked very closely with local government issues in this parliament. They worked very closely with Mr. Musa's former Department of Provincial and Local Government. So Kevin Patrick is back in South Africa in a new role. He is here on behalf of, I think, Acadia University. And he's involved in an internship program which reaches out to universities here, but also to Parliament. He's negotiating at the moment to have a system of internship for American students. So welcome to him. Also some in-house... Okay. Just very quickly, also, Jacob Marocha, is that correct? He's in the other committee, is that right? Yeah, he's in the Minerals and Energy Committee this morning, but you would have gathered from the media that he's the new CE, taking over from Rani Gavashi. We want to congratulate him on his appointment, and also to wish Rani well, you know, but we're going to see him certainly before the year is out. I also know that a not insignificant political party in this country is also having a succession issue to deal with in December. And I hope some lessons can be drawn from the very orderly succession management issues that ESCOM has been able to do. And the chairperson of the ESCOM board is also a not insignificant player in that not insignificant political party, and hopefully he'll take those lessons there too. But I want to congratulate ESCOM in these days of turbulence and conflict about succession, the way they manage. On a more serious note, though, it is remarkable, Ms. Musa, that ESCOM has, on a more serious note, just you can quote me on Linda, not that you do, but I mean, if there's anything I've said of any value, it's this. I think, anyway, for what it's worth, I'm prescribing to you what to say. But I really do think, on a more serious note, that ESCOM has managed this very well. It's a good 10 months ahead before the incumbent leaves, and they've already found a successor. And, you know, from what I read in the paper, it's actually believed, Linda, there were 270 applicants and so on. It's very impressive. So we're going to congratulate them in handling that in the way they have. Then, very quickly, some in-house announcements. One is that we sought to have this as a joint committee meeting of Minerals and Energy and ourselves. Unfortunately, that didn't work out, and I think on both sides there's a regret about it. Two is that our program will change substantially now. The draft program circulated will have to change because the InfraCoBo and the South African Airways Expresso have yet to be approved by Cabinet. I think that will happen next week. Am I right, Oliva? So we can't, obviously, proceed with those bills next week. So we will change the program. Thirdly, the secretary of this committee is no more with us. Not quite clear, but I understand he's leaving Parliament. but I'm not sure about it. There are negotiations at the moment between the committee system management and the committee secretary. So we will, in fact, have a new committee secretary in the next 10 days or so. So I apologize to people for, you know, the difficulties over the last 10 days or so, but we've been functioning effectively without our committee secretary. But if anybody has raised matters around that, we can do that later.
Sure.
Sorry? Let's not discuss that in an open forum unless the person concerned is here to also respond. So having said that, Mr. Musa will initially speak on behalf of ESCOM. Everybody, I think, has got the slides. Just to mention very quickly, what we had asked for as the basis of the exchange is in a letter to Mr. Gamache. It actually asked, essentially we simply established, these are the questions we asked, what was the cause of the national outages on 18 January 2007? Why were these outages not anticipated? What are the implications of these outages for the supply of electricity over the next few years, in particular this year, in particular during winter? What is the latest update in respect of progress in regard to the generation of new electricity? This should be a brief update because we are getting, for those of you who don't know, quarterly reports from the department on the program, both programs. So, and we're going to shortly have yet another quarterly report. So we don't want that to be too long. What role can the public play in conserving energy? And what role do you think Parliament can play in this regard? So it's around these issues. So I'll hand over then to Mr. Musa and then Mr. Gavashi will go from there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman, and greetings to the members of Parliament and everybody present here. As always, it is a tremendous pleasure to be with you. The presentation on behalf of ESCOM would be done by the Chief Executive. I would like to just make a few comments by way of introduction, and particularly a few comments from the point of view of the board of ESCOM. As you're aware that in spite of ESCOM not being a JSE-listed entity, it has an independent, non-executive board of directors. The overwhelming majority of the members of the board are non-executive and independent, and I think that's important for Parliament to know, because a utility like ESCOM should be answerable to the and responsible to the people of the country, and should be made answerable through representatives of the people. So it is a pleasure for us to be here, and especially a special pleasure for me, I think, that we have this situation and quite an active parliamentary committee in this regard. We are at a time, and you will hear this from the Chief Executive as we're going forward over the next few years, we are at a time when corporate governance of an entity like ESCOM becomes particularly important. You would know that if ESCOM was a publicly listed company, it would have been one of the biggest companies in the country. It certainly has the biggest capital expenditure plans of any company, public or private, in the Republic. And the contracts and the tenders that are being awarded as we speak and that would be awarded over the next few years are worth numbers that make the mind boggle. And therefore, corporate governance becomes all the more important. And I would like to assure Parliament that we have an excellent board that places a tremendous amount of emphasis on ensuring that that this is in place. And certainly we're fortunate enough to have an executive team at ESCOM that also places tremendously high value on this whole aspect. We're of course here to share some views about the events of the 18th of January. What you will hear is that we as a country, we're not necessarily at the absolute limits of the capacity that exists, the power generation capacity that exists in the country. However, the margin that does exist, the reserve margin, is not big enough to deal with all eventualities. It is rather a thin margin, And that in the middle of summer, when a number of power stations are switched off for the purposes of maintenance, that margin is reduced to virtually zero. And under those circumstances, if something goes wrong, then there will be inconvenience that is going to be experienced. And that's an inconvenience that that we face over the next few years. And it really occurs, it can occur at any time of the year, but it's in the period in the middle of summer when Eskom feels most confident to switch off power stations in order for maintenance purposes. And it's good that that happens, because if you don't maintain your power stations, then you're going to have bigger problems in the long run. So that's what happens. And then, of course, in the winter period, when, and again, during winter, it's not the whole day, but certain hours of the day when the demand is so high that the entire reserve margin is being used up, then again, we're in a sort of period when, moments when things can go wrong. So things can go wrong over the next year.
And of course, I think at your point, the committee is well aware of
the historical part of this thing, and there's no need for us, I think, to regurgitate all of that. But for good or for bad reason, this country was of the view that Eskom should not expand its capacity for almost an entire decade. That was our policy. It was, of course, not the right policy, as we can see now. But that's what happened, and that's behind us now. I think what's important now what you will hear from the chief executive is that during these critical periods, we want to ensure that Eskom is in control. That if things go wrong, we want the public to be absolutely assured that the wheels are not coming off. Because sometimes that's the impression that people get, that, oh, well, the lights have gone off, we were not given warning about it, the wheels are coming off, you know, the country is going off the rails. We just want to give the absolute assurance that there is no such thing. So the chief executive will inform you what happened on the 18th. I can tell you, he may not say it, that in the early hours of the morning, you're talking about in the period of 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., the entire top executive team of Eskom rolled out of bed, were at their stations trying to get the system working, and it literally took, it didn't take more than 12 hours to get the entire system back on track. He will also tell you that there wasn't a general blackout. There were inconveniences, yes, but that the actual cutoffs were of limited duration and in limited parts of the country, and that before sundown of the same day, the entire system was up and running again. I think the one thing that when we looked at this matter, we thought that we could learn a lesson from the 18th was to improve the communication to the public. On that occasion, it would have been possible for us to give. You can't give a week's warning that your lights are going to go off, because you don't know that the machine is going to break down at 1 a.m. in the morning. But we think on that occasion we could have given like 1 or 2 hours warning. And I think even that would have been appreciated. But as always, the sort of the opportunity cost of that, do you spend your time trying to get the system up and running, or do you spend your time giving interviews to journalists? And I think that's just always going to be a difficult question for anybody to answer in that regard. You will hear that the plans that we spoke about a year ago and 2 years ago about the expansion plan and the capital expenditure plan are all on track. I have discussed with the chief executive. He's informed me that he intends to touch on that, because this is an important topic for the public, you know. It's good enough to have plans, but are they happening? So we hope that we can just give you a bit more detail on that. And then as far as going forward is concerned, into the future, Eskom is at a very, in a sense, at a turning point in its life. And I think that the power sector in this country is also at a turning point. We have largely been a cheap coal producing electricity economy for few generations now, and the next two generations things will have to be different for a variety of reasons. One of the most important is that climate change is for real and global warming is for real, and that's something which this country will have to come to terms with. And taking that into account and adjusting our strategy in order to take into account the reality of global warming may come at a cost, but it certainly what it means is that there will have to be a step change in the technologies that we use and the approaches that we use, and I think the chief executive will also touch on a few of those. But thank you very much. With those words of introduction, I'd like to ask you to call on the chief executive.
Thank you very much, Chairman, for the opportunity. The temperature in this room, I'm not sure that it's reflective of the global warming the Chairman spoke about, or if it's power saving, whichever way I think it's reflective of the times.
No, I mean, the committee's exercise.
I've asked Karen to go see them because I think they are heated under here, which are actually all of us. Because of the air conditioning, there's a hawk, but the heaters are not.
Chairman, thank you very much.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And good morning to members of the committee. Once again, thank you for the opportunity. I think it's very important that we engage with the committee at this time on these very important issues. Before I actually go through the presentation, I thought I'd just make some comments also, which in my view will try to reflect in a nutshell what it is that we'll be trying to communicate. And the first is that looking at our system as a whole, we have a problem at the moment. We have a problem, and that problem is really caused by a number of factors that I'll speak about. And I'll then also just make some comments about what we are doing about it. The problem is that our installed capacity, although sufficient to meet supply, does not allow us a margin that enables us to deal with any eventuality to the system, that is, any breakdown that may be unplanned. And I think that's the core of the problem. Secondly, if one looks at the transmission system, we have constraints on certain power transmission corridors, which means that even on those corridors, if we have certain contingencies developing, we would have some difficulty in dealing with them. Further down the value chain, at the distribution level, particularly now looking right across the system, not just Eskom, but municipalities as well, there is definitely a backlog in investment in infrastructure, and it will take a while to catch up with this. But the result of that is that we see on occasion the inability to restore customers because the systems are not automated and involve physically going around to put customers back on with all the attendant inconvenience to the public. But also the issue of reliability of those networks is actually compromised by the backlog in investment that is still to happen. What were the causes? Clearly, there's been a delay in building new generation capacity. The chairman has touched on the reasons for that. Secondly, some municipalities seem to have taken a conscious decision to delay investment pending the restructuring of the distribution industry. And that has contributed to the backlog that I spoke about. But also, very importantly, faster economic growth than had been anticipated has also meant that we have a much bigger demand to deal with at a time when, in fact, the investment has not kept pace with that particular demand. What are we doing? We've spoken in the past about firstly returning stations to service, those that are mothballed. We have said before that that will give an additional 3,600 megawatts when all those stations are functioning. By June of this year, we expect that 1,100 of that will already be functioning, and I'll touch on that later on in the presentation. We also have committed 97 billion rand to a capital expansion program that is well underway. The year before the current financial year, we already spent about 10 billion on infrastructure. This financial year, we'll be spending a further 16 billion, and we're just finalizing the budgets for next year. But I can indicate that it will be an even higher amount. So not only have we started implementing, we are in fact increasing the expenditure year by year. What we're also doing is engaging utilities within SADC. We have a Southern African power pool, which is a cooperative pool with 12 members, and we're looking at all possibilities for further imports from those utilities, which in fact can augment our supplies. And very importantly, we're engaged in promoting the efficient use of energy. We have a major demand-side management program that is in fact happening as we speak, but is going to be accelerated and implemented on a very broad national scale. And Chairman, just to conclude these opening remarks, I do want to say that insurmountable as these problems may seem, I think we should not lose sight of the fact that we have 32,000 very loyal staff at Eskom who work tirelessly to ensure that the system keeps running and that the inconveniences are minimized. And that gives me confidence because I know the work that those people are doing, everybody in the organization. If I may then go to the presentation, which will in fact attempt to answer the questions that you've asked, but will emphasize hopefully more on what it is that needs to happen going forward, so that perhaps we can start to collectively have a clear understanding and collectively try to contribute towards the solution. The presentation itself will be in five sections. Firstly, the background, which I think is essential to understanding the events of the 18th. And then I will look at the events of that week leading up to the 18th. And then talk about what we're doing, a progress update as requested on the expansion of capacity, and then demand-side management, which is importantly an initiative that we believe will make a difference. Chair, you might recall when we were here in May to address the committee on what had happened in the Western Cape and what the likelihood of the winter and the rest of the year would be in terms of supply, we gave a picture. And in fact, for the rest of the year, there were no problems. I want to update that by indicating the level of capacity that is available or was available as of 1st of January, which would be 36,748 megawatts, without counting Cahora Bassa. And the allocation at that particular time was a further 1,150 megawatts. Now, this is power that we import from Mozambique. It's very much a part of our supply system, and we get that on a continuous basis. The projection for the 1st of June this year is that we will be having available 38,368 megawatts. Again, we have not included Cotabato, which after some repairs on the transmission station, will have gone up to a more reliable 1,450 megawatts of supply. The reasons for the increase in available capacity, we've talked about the projects at Atlantis and Mossel Bay, and I would urge members of the committee, if they have time, Atlantis is just up the coast. We have power being generated there as we speak, and I'll mention that a bit later. But by June, the date of that projection, we'll be having 1,050 megawatts from those two power stations available. These are peaking plants, so ideally to be used during the peak for an hour or an hour and a bit as required. Then, through the program of returning to service, the old plants that were mothballed, by June, we will have a further 1,110 megawatts available on the system, and I'll say a bit more about that. During last year, we had to meet a peak demand of 34,800 megawatts. That was a record. Never before in the history of Eskom have we had to meet demand at that level, and it was met on the 29th of June last year. The projection and the forecast for this year is that that peak will have grown to 36,306 megawatts, indicating that the rate of growth in our system. I'll come back to forecasting in a minute. The issue then is, with that given capacity and that demand, the reserve margins now sits between 8 and 10%, and ideally, it should be at 15%. That is a minimum level that allows you to operate plants, allowing for sufficient breakdowns and so on. That reserve margin, that's just giving you a snapshot of what has happened. In 2001, we're sitting well above that benchmark of 15% at 25%. And it has steadily come down to where in 2005 it was 16, and as I said earlier, now sits between 8 and 10. Why did the reserve margin decline? Probably the most important point is that we in fact have had an increase in our customer base. Roughly in 2001, we had just under 2 million customers. On our system right now, we're sitting just under 4 million. And of course, that is right across the board. We've had electrification contributing a lot to the numbers, not so much to the general demand, although households do contribute more to the peak demand. But you've also had major industrial projects being commissioned in that time, and you've also had underlying growth in GDP, which has meant that general consumption has gone up in the system. And that's the second point, the middle point, that the growth in the last 3 years has certainly been higher than was in fact anticipated. There was a time, and we did express the view a few years ago, that what we saw on demand growth did not correlate with what was being reported as GDP growth. We made that point, and of course, that the GDP numbers have since been revised, and I think the evidence of a fast-growing economy is there for everybody to see. But then, of course, the construction also started late. It's only in 2004 that we were able to start the construction of new plant. Although it must be mentioned that in that time we had started to plan for a number of projects, and particularly the return to service of stations, which was not actually new construction. So that is the background about the system. An important factor that comes into play with events, understanding the events of the 18th, is the issue of maintenance. And I really just want to briefly touch on how we approach this and what is entailed. The first thing is that we have to coordinate outages, that is, when we're going to take plant off to go and do maintenance as required. And we have to look at what the transmission system is going to be like, and we have to get our system ops to help identify the right windows for doing particular maintenance. We have what you call an optimization workshop every year, which will then give us a view of what this maintenance could be like for the whole year. We then also look at weekly load forecasts, and that is run over a two-year period. Given what we know about what's happening in the economy, the outlook for weather, the forecasts that are there, we then build into a model some load forecast over an extended period. We then also look at weekly forecasted demand against what is likely to be available in that week. And then the schedules are done, typically between January and May, and then also August to December, because those are the times of lower consumption in the system. We definitely would not schedule maintenance outages during the winter period, because that is when demand is greatest. And the next slide illustrates this graphically, and it appears a very busy slide, but the focus really of what I want to point out is the green areas, if you look at those. Now, this would be this year, February to December, and then this is the outlook for next year. And you can see the blue line there represents maximum demand, what we think and forecast to be maximum demand for the period. And then the green above it would be the maintenance that we wish to do. So just ahead of this in January, that is the kind of demand we're looking to meet, and that's the load that we're taking off for maintenance. And as the year progresses and the winter gets near, this diminishes up to a point where around June, July, there's actually no planned maintenance. And then around August, it starts again, allowing us to go into December and do the maintenance. If I can just point out, the black line at the top illustrates the level of capacity that is available in the system. And you can see that that is a line that is growing throughout this period, and that as we add units onto the system, capacity then grows with it. But when we talked earlier about the system being tight, typically that black line should be sitting above all of these graphs, because the yellow at the top is what you call operating reserve. In other words, you must have in either spinning reserve or plants that are on but not being used, as well as plants that are in cold reserve that are not being used and are not on. You must have that buffer, which then allows you to deal with any breakages in the system. So the system is tied in that the black line sits below the yellow line. And it's going to take us several years of building to ultimately get us clearly above that. So that really captures the extent of the challenge that we face. I must also say that when I was here in May of last year, I showed a similar slide, and that black line was a bit higher than it is there, and that's because demand is pushing from the bottom. So we are not building fast enough to meet the demand that is growing. Just a few words about forecast, because that's what really plays an important part in this whole system, trying to manage the system. It is a variable in the equation, because no one is able to forecast with absolute accuracy as to what may or may not happen. You could have a weekly forecast that looks generally, and in fact will pan out on average, to be quite in order, but within that, you could have days that deviate quite substantially from the margin that you focus around. But what we do try and do, we have models that help us do this, and the first thing we focus on is looking at the change of the structure in the economy. We've generally been a resource-heavy in this economy, and over time, it's changing to be a service oriented economy, but one also that is relying increasingly on electronics and IT, and therefore requiring higher quality of supply as well as increased reliability. So one has to track all of those changes in the economy and try and cater for those in the forecast. There will always be uncertainty, so we operate in a cone. We say that's the likely path, that's a high growth and a low growth around that likely path. We also then look at GDP forecasts.
Other members, what do you mean cone approach?
I think this would illustrate it.
Oh,
okay. For instance, we would say that GDP growth moderate is about 4.2%, but there's a lower line of 3% and a higher line of 5%, and that gives you a cone so that you're planning to be able to meet requirements within that. But it's a little bit more volatile when it comes to energy demand. For instance, I did say that we're quite a resource-heavy economy, so the level of commodity prices globally will impact whether certain smelting companies stay online or shut off, dependent on the price that they're getting. And those decisions bring about volatility in terms of requirements. Just a little bit more about forecasts. We then use what we call an hourly load model, which then would look at profiles across six economic sectors, and would then, out of that, create energy forecasts and look at the losses that are likely to be incurred in the system. But the outcome of that is we then have an hourly maximum demand number for a number of years. In fact, we cover the entire ISEP, or our strategic planning period, which is about 20 years. But the issue really about forecasting is that, firstly, it is impossible to get it as accurately as the reality pans out, but that secondly, there is volatility that comes into this. Let me then give a view of what the picture for the summer was, based on all of this modeling and forecasting. Just to run briefly on what the color coding actually means, if things are green, and we've tried to align this with the power alert that you see on television, if we're in the green zone, it means that our actual supply is more than the required supply. So we're sitting, and it allows us to meet what I referred to earlier as an operating reserve of 1,900 megawatts. So we're sitting 1,900 megawatts comfortably above what is required to meet the particular load. If we're in the yellow, it means that same equation, in that same equation, there's a deficit of 1,000 megawatts. But we can make this up using a demand market participation, DMP, which is a system whereby we contract upfront with certain customers that we will buy back from them supply. We'll pay for them to be off the system for a certain requirement of power. So that would mean we can manage that in that way. If we're in the orange, then it means that deficit is about 2,000 megawatts. And in that instance, we would use both the DMP and the interruptible loads that are available. I think we've talked about this before, where we have certain contracts with big smelters in particular, where by agreement, it's in the tariff, we're allowed to interrupt them for a given period in a week. So up to the green, yellow, orange means that the public would not even be aware that there's a problem. Once we start going into the red, it now means our deficit is between 2,000 and 3,000 megawatts. And at this point, we will apply the interruptibles, we'll apply demand market participation, but we'll still have a deficit, and there may be some load shedding that starts. And it gets progressively worse until you get to brown, which is where you then have rotating mandatory load shedding throughout the country. Now, if we look at the chart, and we look at the week of the 15th, which is where we were, we knew that we were going to be in the orange. And this is really driven by the level of maintenance that's been done. And I'll come to the number of how much was actually being maintained in that time. So just to remember that operating reserve is 1,900 megawatts, and unplanned losses, unplanned allowance, that is, plants that may then still go off without us planning it, would be a further 1,500 megawatts. So that is how these figures are derived. So it's what's available, and we take out of it 1,900 for the operating reserve, 1,500 for the unplanned allowance. Then you end up with a figure which is either in the deficit or in the positive. If you then take the same picture and you increase the unplanned allowance to 2,000, now this is a sensitivity that we run and say, what will the picture look like? And still you're not in the brown, you've got green, yellow and orange. So it would mean that that should still be manageable. And this is actually quite important, because when things did go wrong in that week, that unplanned allowance went up as much as 4,000 megawatts. And that meant we really had lost the ability to then deal with that. The outlook for the winter, you will notice that there is more green and yellow right in the middle of winter from May up to September. And I need to communicate this very carefully. What this says is that because we have done the maintenance in the summer months, more plants will be available in the winter months. And therefore, we will be able to meet supply in the winter months. To remind the committee again, this is based on a forecast and based on the maintenance we've done. The risk is you could have a higher unplanned breakdown level than you've allowed. In this case, we would have allowed an unplanned allowance of 1,500 megawatts. So it is not that we want to portray a positive picture. The reality is the planning we do, based on the forecast, would in fact enable us to feel that we would have a manageable situation over that period, except for anything that is unplanned, which then could change that picture. Again, the sensitivity on that, if we increase the unplanned allowance from 1,500 to 2,000 megawatts, you then end up with a bit more orange, and you start seeing a red in April. Okay, so we're aware of that well in advance, and therefore would need to find some mitigating actions so that the red does not eventuate. But we are aware of it as early as now that on the week of the 30th of April, there'll be a problem. We're still in maintenance. Our maintenance period only ends in May. So we'll have to find contingencies around that. If I then look at what happened on that week and try and just take it slowly to give the explanation. When we started the week, we had as much as 4,934 megawatts being out for maintenance. Because of the maintenance season, we try and maximize this. On the same day, there were unplanned breakages at Camden and Matimba, two power stations, resulting in a loss of 975 megawatts. Now, none of these were long-term problems. The expectation with some of those breakages was that within 24 hours, or maximum 48 hours, the units would be repaired and would be back in operation. Then on the 17th, there were further breakdowns at those power stations. And here we're talking about units, so it's not the entire power station. Each power station has on average 6 units, and we're talking about units of those power stations being lost. So we then had, in addition to Camden and Matimba, there was a problem at Majuba, Creel, and Tutuga power stations. And that meant a total of 2,704 megawatts were lost, no longer available. And if you recall my earlier discussion, the allowance is 1,500. So already we could see that we were in a tight position. We utilized interruptibles and we utilize DMP with customers that were available, and we managed to get through that day. Then on the 18th, already sitting at 2,700, we had further breakdowns at Kuberg, Matimba, and Henrina, and this took place between 2 and 2:30 a.m. on the morning of the 18th. So what actually happened here, I personally was away on business in Namibia, but from 10 o'clock, I was in touch and made aware of the situation there, that we are now sitting a little bit above the allowance for breakdowns. And at 2:30 a.m., I was in touch with the office, and after these incidents happened, and became clear that we were going to have a problem. But going further, still after 2 a.m., between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., there were further breakdowns at Arnott and Tutuga, giving us now a total of 4,900 megawatts unplanned, well over the allowance of 1,500. And if you then take that together with what was planned, you are now sitting just under 10,000 megawatts, which are off the system. We then convened an emergency response command center at 4 a.m., and I was on touch on the phone because I wasn't there physically, and we then started planning for what would happen. Now, this is quite crucial because what we said was we need to assess where we are. We've lost units, we know where we are, but we need to assess which of those units are likely to come back in time to relieve the load the next morning. And so the teams convened at 4 and met up to about 6, where it was then becoming clear that we're not going to have any units coming back, and therefore the situations are going to change. And I think this is the point the chairman made about communication. We waited until we were absolutely sure around 7 o'clock before we started communicating. And I think with hindsight and the lessons to be learned is that we could have communicated from about 5 o'clock once we had assessed the information at that meeting. But it took that much longer just to confirm things and say that we are going to have this problem. Load shedding then started at about 8 o'clock. In fact, that was the preliminary figure, and the final figure is just about 4,000 megawatts that was eventually shared during the day. Restoration began at 11:09. In other words, some of these units started coming back into service, and so we're able to start restoring slowly. But that took us up to 22:05 in the afternoon, whereby all load had been restored. Again, the point that was made earlier, that is at a bulk supply level, so that's the transmission system feeding into substations. What happens beyond that is then a function of how the municipal or local ESCOM systems are. And in some instances where it is manual, it takes that much longer to get customers back. The lessons learned, I think I've touched on most of them. I think alerting the country early to a potential problem, that's our lesson, and something that we already have sorted out internally. You would have noticed, I think, in the 2 weeks that followed, we're able to give 3-day advance warning that there could be a problem in the event no problem came about, but we were able to give warning ahead of time. Emergency response centers, I talked about the national command center. We're in the process of establishing regional command centers, and some of them did not convene, even though at control centers were in full communication with those who are controlling the system. But these are across the divisions teams that sit together and are able to look at the problems regionally and give useful information back to national control about the state of the system where they are. That's another thing that we're expediting. The schedules were ready in some places, and in fact the Western Cape was way ahead of everybody else. They had schedules, and so the implementation was orderly, unlike other places where those schedules were put together as the day advanced. And we also had a bit of congestion on our website with everybody coming on, but we've since dealt with the capacity and are able to allow everybody in. And then communication with stakeholders in an emergency. We've certainly put a focus on that. So just some of the risks that remain, and I think we need to be all aware of. If you lose a nuclear unit, it's 900 megawatts out of the system at one time, and that is a key risk. But also coal units are large units, 600 megawatts. So given that the situation is tight, a number of these occurring close to one another or at the same time would in fact end up with a situation where we do not have enough supply. Outages of one or two lines along the major transmission corridors would also present us with a problem, but we have contingency plans, we have spares that are located or distributed geographically along those corridors that we know are under pressure, and of course money has since been approved to build further capacity on those transmission lines, and that is going on as we speak. Premature failure of large generation and transmission transformers. This is a risk we've been managing over the last 3 years, and in fact, we are now at a point where it's almost it's a much lesser risk than it was. And this simply is a fleet of transformers that we had, large transformers that we had, that have not been performing according to that design life and the specification. And we've had to change those out, and that risk remains, but it's a much smaller risk now. Aging of plants. The plant is in midlife. It's at a point where major refurbishment has to be done. There are a number of risks associated with doing that major refurbishment. For instance, new control and instrumentation systems would in fact be subject to some failure and have to be replaced, but then the new ones also would take time for the commissioning and people to get used to them, and there's a time of risk while that is happening. Also, your turbine components start to fail due to aging and require major outages to actually deal with those. The risk of not meeting environmental requirements as a result of emissions. We are now burning these stations, running them harder than they were designed, and in some instances, there's a possible threat to emission limits, and we would have to observe that and maybe reduce power to meet those particular standards. Stockpiles of coal, if there were to be any dramatic reductions. We've had a particular problem is that of excessive rainfall, which can lead to flooding of mines, and then we're not able to get the coal out when we're supposed to. Also given the general level of operation, which is much higher than what the plans are catered for, having to rely on road transportation to move coal around brings with it a whole lot of other risks. But that has been managed. All our stockpiles are sitting at levels that are adequate to meet the system requirements. Also, the issue of liquid fuels. As we commission turbines, we have to then also be mindful of what is the supply situation with regards to liquid fuels. So those are just some of the key risks, and I think that would really summarize the issue of what the system is like, what is critical in understanding the events of the 18th, what happened on the 18th, and these are the risks that we continue to manage on an ongoing basis. To move on to an update on the expansion program, this is a diagram I think the committee will be familiar with. In there is a mix of plant that is in various stages of planning and implementation. We announced that our program 2 years ago, we announced that we'd be spending 84 billion rand, and as the year progressed, or rather into the next year, the next CAPEX plan was for 97 billion rand. Later on in this quarter, the board will approve the next CAPEX plan, and the likelihood is that it will be higher still. So the implementation is taking place, and the reason we are seeing higher and higher expenditure is that we're accelerating, we're bringing forward some of these projects so that they can happen quicker. What this essentially shows is that in the current phase of approved projects that are under construction, we have as much as 10,000 megawatts and two major transmission lines that are in the stage of being implemented. And one of the things you'll notice is that the colors are quite many, many different colors. And that is to show different kinds of capacity. We have looked at the portfolio we're developing going forward, coming from a very heavy coal base. And the board have actually made sure that in the planning for future capacity, we start to diversify the investments that we make. So you will see that in this funnel would be hydro projects, for instance, and some of those are either pump storage within our country or projects that are in the region. You then also have nuclear, which is a good baseload technology that we will require in the system. And you'll see that in the feasibility and business case phase, versus a nuclear plant. You have gas and the turbines that we spoke about, but you also have new coal, because coal is still a useful baseload technology. So you have a number of coal-fired stations that are in the process or just ahead of investment approvals. We have solar, which would be, in fact, still in the research phase, a large-scale 100 megawatt concentrating solar project that we hope to pilot somewhere in the western, in the Northern Cape. You'd also have wind, which has now been approved, and there it sits as a 100 megawatt project to be built somewhere here in the Western Cape. So that, in fact, really shows that not only are the plans, but that they're being implemented, and that in the planning, certainly, there is sufficient capacity to start meeting what will be required by the system. The difficulty, of course, are the lead times, that most of these technologies will take 48 to maybe 60 months, or a bit longer, to actually complete and commission. Just coming a little bit closer on certain specific projects, just to give an update. The faces would indicate the level of progress that is being made on a variety of projects. Camden, that face, in fact, probably ought to change to a yellow. At 12:30 this morning, I got an SMS that Unit 4 had, in fact, synchronized to the grid and is producing as we speak. But, of course, it's going through its commissioning stages. So, in fact, at Camden Power Station, we now have 5 units that are generating. And that is something that we're particularly pleased with. In this instance, it actually indicates that what we thought had slipped to the end of March, in fact, happened during February, early hours of this morning. Crotchley, we have the first unit that was planned for September and has now been accelerated to May. And the prospects look good that that will be met. The teams continue to work very hard on that. Komati, which is the third of the mothballed stations, was planned, the first unit, for September of next year. We're looking at a 12-month acceleration. And again, for the moment, it would appear that progress is such that we might be able to do that. The open cycle gas turbines, Atlantis and Mossel Bay, we have said here that by winter of 2007, those will be on stream. And as I mentioned earlier, the first of the units in Atlantis is generating at about 135 megawatts. We expect that by this Friday, the first of the Mossel Bay units will be on the grid as well. I again invite the committee to visit these plants if there is a chance to see the work that's being done. That is a pump storage scheme on the Drakensberg. It's progressing well. It is on schedule, and we believe will in fact achieve the commissioning dates that have been planned. We then get on to the first of the new coal-fired stations, which is planned for Lephalale in Limpopo. Some delays being experienced. We have appeals that have been dealt with in the EIA process, and we would have liked to be on site in February, but it appears that that is under threat. It will take 48 months for the first of those units to be commissioned. And so we're a bit concerned that unless we can clear these quickly and get permission to get on site, time will start to slip. What we're calling Gas 1 here is an extension of the Atlantis project, and would be expecting that we'll get licensing as well as a positive record of decision to allow us to start moving on that project. It's not green because those things are a little bit delayed. There's a process, a new process that is being followed, following on the Electricity Act Electricity Regulation Act of last year, and we are working with the Department of Environment as well as the regulators to try and expedite that. This is I showed two transmission projects earlier. Both, in fact, are behind schedule. One having, inclement weather delayed construction. There was the heavy rains we had last year. But then also servitude issues, trying to secure all the servitudes where the lines have to go, is not always possible, and we've had difficulty here. And the completion date of June this year is under threat. With the other line going into Limpopo, we also have a land acquisition and servitude issues that are causing a delay. In fact, it's just a stretch of 10 kilometers along the entire line that we have not been able to secure servitudes for, but are still in the process of doing that. Further servitude issues with the 765 to the Cape, some of those have been issues that have appeared in the media. But that is the progress that we believe is in fact going to contribute to us starting to meet this particular challenge that we face. Now, in the meantime, and in fact...
Sorry, I don't want to be rude, I'm concerned about time.
Yeah, I'll,
this is very crucial. I know this is in fact the main thing you want to address. But some of the issues we are familiar with.
Yes, I'll go very fast.
Okay.
Demand-side management, I think a lot of lessons were learned in the case. In essence, we are now advocating for a much more ambitious national plan around demand-side management. We would like to see 3,000 megawatts over the next 6 years being taken out of the system. That's close to an entire power station. And we are already finalizing plans and will get all the necessary approvals so that this can be launched as a national project very soon. The question is, what can the public do? And the message, and we're going to be reinforcing this using the media and any other channel that's available, that we need to use electricity sparingly. The days of excess capacity are no longer here, and we have to use what we have very sparingly so that we can continue to have enough to meet the growth that is taking place in our economy. And we mentioned some of the things that the public can do. This is merely by way of highlighting. We'll obviously have intensive communication on what, in fact, the public can do. The power alert on SABC TV, we particularly want to encourage people to observe, because that makes a big difference during those peak times that we saw earlier on. What leadership can do is really setting the example, and I do know that the parliament buildings have been retrofitted with efficient lighting, and we commend that. But I think as leaders, wherever we are in our constituencies, we could in fact do more to support the energy efficiency drive. As Eskom, we've undertaken to champion this in many ways that will become increasingly evident, but also to highlight that we have an internal program within Eskom We call it the billion kilowatt hour campaign. We use up about 5% of the total output of electricity in this country, using that on our own buildings and the power stations, and included in that would be losses that occur in the lines. And we launched this program early last year, and we already have savings of 14,532 megawatt hours just on our system alone. And we know that we have a long way to go to get to the full billion kilowatt hour. To conclude, Chair, I think that the plans are there to address what needs to be addressed in the interim. We have a number of contingencies under the auspices of what we call TERCO, which is our response center, looking at requirements in the medium term. We are also advocating and promoting DSM so that we can manage the load growth, which, as I showed earlier in my discussion, is contributing a lot to the constraints that we face. We appeal to the public, we appeal to leadership everywhere, to say by changing the way we use electricity, we can in fact have enough to meet all of our needs and not in any way delay the growth or slow down the growth that is occurring in the economy. Thank you very much.
Anand Vakanti, what time is the tea? Is it 11? 11. We spoke to the department. They said 10, 15 minutes. That's fine, because we can come back to you. You know, the two main inputs, if you like, you and South agree, are Professor Eberhard and the ESCOM. So shall we go for a change? I've been given copies of the report, and there's a summary that Eric Boscati, our secretary, did. I don't know if the DA or other parties got that. Was it sent through the committee section? Did you get it, sir?
I will be talking about the document that was referred to in the Sunday Times on the 4th of February, which was called the Review of Security of Supply in South Africa. Sorry? Yes, that's correct. What basically that report or the article left the impression that in the midst of what was happening in the country, the government has been informed of all these risks earlier and nothing was happening. And I want to emphasize the fact that that was not true. You have heard earlier from ESCOM what has been done and some of the decisions that have been taken to deal with the